Hey there, foreigners. This is Rohit from BreakingTheBorders.com, home of the ambitious immigrants. Today's guest is Raj Daniels. Raj is a serial entrepreneur. He started several businesses. His latest one is Open Time App. It lets you send your available times to your network. And talking about network, Raj is very good at networking. In fact, his networking skills were mentioned by one of my earlier guests, Andrew Warner, who taught a course on networking skills here on Breaking the Borders. I'm very excited to be talking to Raj today. Raj, welcome to Breaking the Borders podcast.
Good morning.
When did you move to the US?
We moved in the late 80s.
With your parents?
Correct.
I see. What were you doing before that?
I was in secondary school in London.
Okay. How did your parents end up there in London?
I like to joke. So my parents were in East Africa.
Uh-huh.
And they immigrated to London.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're familiar with the East African continent, you know there was a lot of issues with Indians during a certain period of time there.
So you were originally Indian, is it?
Yes, that's okay. Correct. I'm actually Gujarati by origin.
I see. And you were born in East Africa?
I was born in London.
Oh, London. Okay. So your parents moved there.
Correct.
I see. How old were you when you moved to the US?
What was I? 15, 16, something?
Okay. So you were a teenager, right?
Yes, I was a teenager, correct.
I see. So you must have already had some culture and the way you grew up in London, which set you on a particular path or which gave you a certain lens to view the world. And it must have been different when you came to the US, right?
You know, it's been different all along. And the one thing I tell people that I like to joke about is that, you know, at home, we have to be a certain way. You know, we eat with our hands. We have our own cultural ways, our cultural norms. But every time we leave the house and go to school, we have to be someone else.
Mm-hmm.
So we're constantly trying to find our identity, if you will. And I'll be, you know, honest with you, there were times where I wished I wasn't Indian, you know, because you're trying to fit in with a particular culture, a particular way, a particular norm. And
what is one of those times?
Yeah, sure. So, for example, you know, like in school, for example, your name stands out. I was in a school where most of the people were Caucasian. So just something simple as your name being different.
Mm-hmm.
And in my case, you know, a first name and a last name being different, meaning that my last name is more, you know, as a Christian background, my first name is an Indian background.
Mm-hmm.
And so just something simple as a name, mm-hmm, can be, you know, a point of question for young children. And then the unfamiliarity with food. So, for example, you know, later in my life, in my secondary school, I would take, you know, maybe some Indian food to school for lunch. And then, you know, you're kind of looked upon differently. You're kind of maybe even ostracized a little bit because you're eating different from whatever else is eating. So there are a couple of times that stood out really quite a bit.
I see. So was there a particular incident that happened because of the food you took?
No, not a particular incident about the food, but London that time was very unfriendly towards Indians.
Mm-hmm.
And so there was this entire movement, and it was called essentially, and it's a derogatory term, but I'll share it anyway. It's called Paki bashing. Mm-hmm. And essentially, you know, there was a big skinhead movement in London. So we spent a lot of our formative years, if you will, fighting with skinheads. I mean, literally fist fighting with skinheads, being bullied because we were Indian. You know, questions about, you know, where's your dot, meaning where, you know, where's your tikka from your forehead, just kind of those kind of things.
Ah, I see. So you had to face all of that as a kid.
It was very tough. I would never, even till this day, I don't have a favorable, I have no reason. I have family in London still, and I stop off in London to see them if I'm going on a trip, but I don't have a fondness for those memories at all.
I see. And is that what made you and your parents move to the US?
No, my parents moved to the US for us. We had family in the US, and they always thought there was going to be better opportunity here, so we moved to the US for that. The irony of that move is that after we moved, I moved to the Dallas area, which I absolutely love. But once I came to the Dallas area, I became essentially, so there's a large Hispanic population here. And so, you know, not being, people here not being familiar with Indians, you kind of get lumped in with the Hispanic population. Mm-hmm. And then you hear derogatory comments, you know, about that population too. So it's been an interesting ride, to say the least.
I see. So even as a teenager, when you moved here, you kind of faced that challenges in Dallas area as well.
Right, right. You mean you come in your formative years again. Again, when we moved here, the Indian population was very, very small. We moved to a predominantly American Caucasian area. And so again, when, you know, you're standing out. There wasn't any incidents of physical harm here. You know, there were relatively safe areas where we lived, but still psychologically, all these things do play with you.
What in terms of this prejudice, right, against, what is the worst that you have ever experienced? Can you tell me like one incident or one moment or one something that happened?
It's a repeated of one. So there are several times back in London when you're walking home from school, and if you're familiar with London at all, you know that it gets dark very early in the evening. So we would cross like small railroad bridges or whatever it might be coming home, and you'd encounter these groups of skinheads, if you will, or, you know, bullies. And I mean, at some times you literally were, you feared for your life sometimes, because you knew that eventually there was going to be some kind of altercation or some kind of fight, something was going to break out. And so there were many, many times like that. Even now, if I'm watching a movie, and if it's a movie set in London, I can almost like, there's a visceral feeling where I can relate to that.
I see. So on the brighter side, right? So you also had started a business when you were a kid with renting videos. What was that?
In London, I tried to be as enterprising as I could. So I used to work in a convenience store for a Patel gentleman. And one of the benefits of working with him was that when videotapes were first introduced in the mid-80s, he would have all these videos and we would rent them out through the store. And so what I would do from him, I would rent a video from him, or I would borrow a video. He was fine, you know, take a video. And I had made a copy of the key to the, it was more like a media room, audio room. I'd make a skeleton key for that. And I would take that key and I would open up the media room during lunch hour. And I would charge my friends and kids in the school, you know, a few pence or a couple of pounds to go in there and watch the videos that I had rented.
I see. So you were actually legally renting them from that guy, but just that you are giving it to your friends for... Was there profits in that? It seems like you are renting it for much lesser. You said you're renting it for a dollar and renting out for pennies.
So if you think about if there's 10 kids in there and they're paying 50 pence a piece to come watch it, that's £5, where my cost to rent was one pound or sometimes zero.
I see. So this is very unusual for a kid to do, right? Renting videos and trying to sell it. What installed that business sense in you? Was your family into entrepreneurship, or how did that happen?
No, they weren't. There's a couple of different things. And interesting, something you said in one of your past interviews, and I'll kind of bring that up later. So I was a very, very heavy kid. I was quite overweight as a kid. And so I would always do different things to try to be popular or fit in. And one of the ways was being enterprising. So if somebody needed something or somebody wanted to get something, then I could be resourceful in that sense. And so, you know, doing this movie show during the lunch hours, if you will, even though I was charging, made me more, I guess, popular or accepted. And so, you know, being the one Indian kid at the school didn't help. So being the minority of the minority. And so I had to think of ways to circumvent some of these other personal issues that I had. And this was one of the ways that I thought about doing it, was being enterprising and resourceful.
I see. So making this difference in yourself made you stand out, which made you feel less like a minority, or which gave you some importance in life.
And it gave me more confidence in one area of life. I wasn't very confident about my health or my aesthetic looks. And so this was absolutely one of the ways that made me stand out, made me feel better.
I see. So you came to the US, did undergrad in University of Texas, right? And
I did.
Then what did you do after that before you started working on your current company?
So I'll actually give you a little bit of background. I didn't go to university directly out of high school. I tell people I took the scenic route, which I absolutely recommend to everyone and anyone. I actually went to flight school. I went to flight school and flew airplanes for a few years. And I really, really enjoyed that. And then after that, I did some work in the family business. And once my father sold off his businesses, then I decided to go into university because now I was more mature.
Let me pause here for a moment. You were talking about how you went into your family business, right? Mm-hmm. Is that mm-hmm. when you invested in a hotel in your mid-20s?
So yes, that was part of it. One of our investments was a hotel investment. Yes,
so what happened to that?
So we learned a very important lesson. So it was my brother, myself, and my cousin, and you know, we invested a good amount of money in the business, and we were happy. We were enjoying it. It was a phenomenal ride while it lasted. What happened was this hotel was based in Wichita Falls, right outside of Air Force Base, and the Air Force Base had some they call it airmen on airmen incidents of underage drinking. And so what they decided to do was they decided to curfew all the properties within 1 mile off the business. And when they did that, we got hit extremely hard and we had to go through an entire bankruptcy process, you know, again, in our mid late 20s.
Wow. That must have been a hard lesson to learn.
It was a very difficult lesson. You know, at the time, very upset, very depressed. You kind of feel like a failure. Now looking back, I reflect and I say that, you know, never rely on one source of business for your portfolio. So even when I'm consulting with clients now, I tell them, if you've got one client providing you more than, you know, 30, 40% of your revenue, you need to really, really reevaluate what you're doing.
I see. So for you, that one client was the Air Force employees, which was not a good idea.
That's correct. Absolutely right.
I see. So how about any of the success that you've had running your family business? Can you share that?
So, you know, I don't want to take any success for my family business. That was my father and his partners. I learned a lot. We were in retail, convenience stores. They invested, you know, a small amount of money when they came to the country, and they grew that to quite a good portfolio. They ended up with about 4 different convenience stores, and they exited. And they did pretty well for themselves. I started doing real estate in the early 2000s, and I was fortunate to make a top 10 list here of closing one of the top real estate leases here in Dallas in 2003.
What does that mean? You'll lease the most number of homes?
One of the largest square footage of commercial properties.
I see. Okay.
And so I enjoyed doing that. What I found about real estate was that I actually enjoyed doing commercial deals more than residential. Mm-hmm. I didn't enjoy showing properties on a residential basis. I enjoyed the business aspect of a commercial deal. So if you're familiar with a commercial deal, then you know that there needs to be a business plan. There needs to be financing, forecasting, projections in order for the landlord to approve the tenant's lease. So I really enjoyed doing the business side of that.
I see. So life seems to be going well for you, right? You're involved with your family business. You had some successes, some failures. Why go back to school?
That's a great question. And so it always plagued my conscience that a lot of my friends and my peers had degrees. And, you know, being an Indian kid without a degree is an outlier, right? All your friends have undergrad, some have master's degrees. And so I thought, let me go figure out and find out what this whole school thing is about. So the good thing was when I went back, I could pick and choose what I wanted to study. And so I ended up studying a combination of international business, history, and I did some marketing too, but I really enjoyed the history part of it. But I went back initially just to see what it was like, and then I decided to continue and finish and get my undergrad in what they call general studies, so a combination of international business and history.
Did you start going part-time or did you dive in full-time immediately?
I started going part-time with a couple of classes, and then by the time my last semester, I think I took 15, 16 hours.
Mm-hmm.
And I was working full-time also.
I see. So when I looked at your LinkedIn profile, I was really surprised. From the time that you graduated to your current company, you don't have much details in there. I'm curious to know what happened in your life at that time.
Sure. So so the LinkedIn profile is by intention.
Okay.
The LinkedIn profile, so when I started OpenTime back in 2014, I guess it was, mm-hmm. I wanted to run an experiment with LinkedIn. Okay.
Okay.
I don't know if you read my summary on LinkedIn or not.
I did. The monkey story. That's a great story. I'm very familiar,
So my experience, what I wanted to do, I wanted to run an experiment to see if I kept randomly changing my LinkedIn profile, mm-hmm. whether the number of requests to connect would increase, decrease, or stay the same.
Okay.
And the reason I ran that experiment is because if you're familiar with my current company, then you know that, you know, our goal is to bring people together face-to-face, so to connect people. Mm-hmm. I just believe there's a lot of value in face-to-face connections. And what I've been teaching a lot of my... So I do a lot of mentoring here with MBA students. And I try to teach them that, you know, taking classes and doing accounting and statistics and everything else is all well and good. But, you know, taking lessons in communication and networking are really going to help you more in your career than you understand. Although they're considered soft skills and you can't really measure them, they're going to take you, you know, extremely far. And so what I was doing with LinkedIn is that running the experiment to see if the number of requests for my connections changed. And it did not. They remained the same, and to some extent, they've gone higher. So what I tell people is that, you know, even though at some points I put ridiculous things on my LinkedIn profile, people don't really take the time to read the summary, read the profiles. They go by the LinkedIn suggestions of, you know, you might want to connect with, and they just kind of go through a list and start clicking.
How long have you done this experiment for?
Late 2014.
Oh, wow. So it's been more than a year.
That's correct.
So what all parameters did you change? What all did you try with?
I've changed several things. If you see on my summary, the first thing it says is, please email me at my Yahoo address.
Uh-huh.
And almost nobody does. I made that the first line because I wanted to make sure that, you know, it wasn't buried somewhere deep where they wouldn't find it. And almost nobody does. The connection requests just come across. I've changed the work history. At one time, there was only my nonprofit activity and no work history. At one time, there were no education on there, just a summary. So I've done several different things to change it just to kind of see what affects it. And honestly, nothing has.
Nothing has. So what is your summary right now? It's a good story. Do you want to tell us what it is?
So it's the story about the monkeys and essentially how when we see one person doing a behavior, we tend to copy it without knowing the reason why.
Mm-hmm.
In a nutshell. And the irony is that at the bottom of that summary, I've actually written a line in Spanish in there.
Yeah.
And if you translate that, if you put that line into Google, it'll tell you that this experiment really never happened.
Oh, okay. And, yeah, I never bothered to translate it. I saw the line, but I was like, okay, maybe that's the summary.
Yeah. So apparently this is folklore, and this experiment never really did happen. Now, best of my knowledge, it did not. It may have happened in different.
I see.
Format somewhere,
so just to give a context to some people listening, the experiment is that there are five monkeys and one of them is... actually, I'll let you tell the story. Do you want to quickly tell what the experiment is?
If I remember correctly, there's a pole with bananas on it. And when one goes to get the banana, he gets electrocuted. And then each one of these five monkeys kind of go through the same process. But it gets interesting when they introduce a new monkey... And they remove the electric shock. The new monkey goes to climb the pole to get the bananas. But before he can even do that, the group holds him back. Mm-hmm. And so it's a great lesson on group thinking and group behavior and how we all try to do things to fit in with other people without even knowing what would happen if we tried something different.
Yeah, and gradually they replace all the monkeys and they take their electrocution out. And mm-hmm. now there are a bunch of five monkeys with no impact for taking the banana. But in spite of that, when one monkey goes to reach for it, everyone takes it down.
Right. So it gives you pause to question, you know, are the people around you that tell you not to do things, have they really experienced what it is to do the thing they're telling you not to do?
Mm-hmm.
So.
Yeah. Yeah. That's one question that I always ask people if they recommend me that I do something a certain way or recommend me that I don't do it. I ask for an example or a reason, and almost like 90% of the people don't have one.
Right. It's, yeah. You know, it's almost like, oh, you know, you shouldn't do that. Well, why not? Well, you know, I heard it didn't work.
Yeah.
So I agree.
So Raj, let me ask you this. What are you most proud of building?
Right now, I would say it's OpenTime. It's the company I'm building right now. And mm-hmm.
Do you want to give a quick 1-minute elevator pitch of what OpenTimer is about? I figured we didn't talk about it, the details of it.
Yeah, sure. So OpenTime app is to facilitate face-to-face meetings and to grow communities. And so what our premise is that people need to build stronger relationships with people in their community. And so we help them by broadcasting their availability through mobile apps and online web services. And what we mean by that is that whether you say it implicitly or explicitly, so, you know, your podcast community or your, you know, your employer has a community, an organization you're with is trying to build a community. We're all implicitly trying to build communities. What we found is that there are two barriers to building these communities. One is time and one is fear. So briefly, time, what is time? Time is the dance of, hey, Rohit, when are you available? I don't know. Let me check my calendar. Let me check my Gmail. Let me check my Outlook. And so we alleviate that by allowing people to broadcast their availability to the designed or specified groups. The second is fear. And what I mean by fear is that people have an intrinsic fear of asking people if they're available, meaning that, you know, I don't know if Rohit really wants to meet with me for coffee or, you know, have me on his podcast or talk to me. And so that fear barrier prevents these communities from congealing the best they can. And so what we're saying is that if Rohit says I'm available to my community, well, now I don't have to ask him if he's available. And so OpenTime is helping address those two issues.
Yeah. So if someone is on open time, when you say broadcasting, what exactly does that mean?
Sure. So you can log on to the mobile application and you can say that, you know, I'm available to meet Wednesday morning from, you know, 11 a.m. to noon. And so our first pillar is going to be availability. So a person is available at this particular time. The second pillar is going to be location. So where he or she is available. So in my case, Raj is available from 11 to 12 in Dallas. And the third pillar is going to be groups. And so you can be part of an open group or a defined group. So right now we're talking to a local community here. We've onboarded our first customer and they're designing a closed group for their community. So their community members can interact with each other. Now, if you have an organization or a company that has maybe an open door policy within the company and you want to encourage mentors and mentees, managers and employees to interact better, you can consider this as a closed community and they can broadcast their availability within that community.
I see. What gave you this idea to build the app?
So I went to a networking meeting. I was going to go back into strategy consulting 2 years ago. And I went to a networking meeting and there were a couple of people on the table complaining about the networking meeting, saying that there's 100 people here. There's two or three rockstar consultants we want to meet with. And, you know, we come here, we get three or four business cards and we leave. Now, having been someone that has taught or teaching people how to network, I've seen this problem before, but that day, for some reason, it really resonated with me. And I thought there's got to be a better way to do this thing. And so I thought, you know, what if there was a way to connect with people after the event, not during the event, but after the event. So essentially, you know, giving the ability to continue the conversation, if you will. And that was where the idea first came from.
I see. And how does OpenTimer help do that?
So OpenTime, we would work with an event organizer and say that, you know, people that come to your event can register onto OpenTime and then you create this group for your event. And so, for example, let's say you had a community event, so Rohit's community event, okay, and, you know, 150 people showed up, you know, a portion of them connected on OpenTime into your group. Well, now once the group leaves your event, people that didn't meet at the event will have the opportunity to meet them afterwards and continue. Your event continues to give them value and they continue to give your event value.
I see. So it they can take the connections outside and
that's
see
correct.
If they can set up time.
Right, exactly.
What has been the most difficult part of starting OpenTime?
You know, there's been so many challenges, you know, from the technology to, you know, one part is also trying to explain to people. Once we tell people, then they come back with, I can't believe it, you know, we can use it in this area. And so we're trying to some extent facilitate a behavior that they already do and trying to show them how to do it through technology. And that's been a challenge. And then just building the application has been a challenge. I'm fortunate that I have a phenomenal co-founder and he's essentially built the iOS, the Android version and the web application for us.
I see. So when you say that telling the people how they can use this app for their existing behavior has been a challenge, what about that is difficult to sell?
Well, you know, people are they're inundated with apps,
mm-hmm.
okay? And so initially out of the gate, it was a very B2C model. It was going to be, you know, build an app, put it in the app store, you know, try to fight for downloads, fight for eyeballs. But then we took, you know, the word may be overplayed, but we took a pivot, or you know, we reframed it and said to ourselves, okay, look, there are communities of people that enjoy meeting together. What if we approached these communities and said, look, we have a better, more improved way for you to meet and grow your communities? And that conversation has been a much easier conversation than the initial conversation of putting it in the App Store. That was going to be an extremely long road to go down.
But you tried going down that road a little bit?
We did not. We were fortunate enough to realize that earlier in the process. So we took that pivot, if you will, early last year when we really started thinking, you know, who would our core users be and why would they be motivated to meet each other? I think motivation is key. And, you know, we need to kind of be kind of followed that. There's a great book by Nir Eyal called Hooked. Mm-hmm. And he talks about the cycle of trigger, action, investment, and reward. And we really kind of laid our app across these quadrants, if you will, and thought to ourselves, you know, who would be rewarded most and who would have the most investment for meeting again and again over time? And so if you have groups of people that share a common interest, then those people are intrinsically motivated to meet each other who share that common interest.
Yeah. I'm asking more details about how you actually did the change in strategy. Was because it's so hard, I see, to see what is wrong with your idea. So how do you differentiate between a bad idea versus a good idea, which is taking time to build momentum?
You know, the short answer is experience, right? Mm-hmm. The one thing that I've been fortunate is that I've spent the last year and a half meeting a lot of people. I count networking as my daily, like it's something I do on a daily basis. I take a very strategic approach to that. And because of that, I'm able to talk to at least two or three what I call new people every single week. And I present the idea from them and I take advice and I do a lot of what Paul Graham talks about is getting out of the building. I talk to a lot of people. I mean, if I tell you that I talked to 100 people last year individually, I mean, I probably would not be overestimating that.
I see. So it is talking to these people that tells you or gives you a hunch about when you're going down the wrong path.
Absolutely. I'll tell you one example where it was, you know, I took one gentleman out for coffee and I showed him the idea. And at that time, it was just a rough PowerPoint presentation animated. And I was kind of going through some different ideas. And he said, look, Raj, I don't care about any of this. I just care about three things. I care about when the person is available. I care about where they are. And I care about, you know, like their profile, like what they do. That's what I care about. And he was, he was extremely curt, but the way he presented it, it was really like an aha, like, okay, those are the three things that this gentleman who runs his own company is really, really interested in. Let me explore that further. And so in exploring those, we were really able to parse out what was more important.
So for someone who is looking to network more, do you have, you say you do it a lot. So I'm wondering if you have any ninja tips up your sleeve that you can share.
So absolutely. So first of all, I tell people, look, regardless of your position in life. So a lot of what the mentoring I do is for people who are in their undergrad and grad school. And, you know, the question I get back often is, you know, how can I help somebody? I say, look, we all have some intrinsic value for somebody. And you're not going to find out how you can help somebody until you meet somebody. And so, you know, there's strategic networking and there's open networking. And so let me define the two. Strategic networking is that you want to get in touch with somebody at a particular company. Well, strategically, then you can start identifying that person. You know, you can use LinkedIn, social media, the internet, whatever you choose to, and try to find out what groups they're interested in. You know, what other interests they have, their second and third degree connections. You can find out who those are. And then you can start to work your way through that chain, if you will. But never with a mentality of, you know, what can I get? I think the mentality always has to be, what can I give? What value can I provide? And that's going to take you a lot further. And so that strategic networking, identifying an individual, and then finding a path to get to that individual. Open networking, which I enjoy just as much, is that, you know, you are open to meeting with people in all areas of life. And I'm a big fan of that because I believe in cross-pollination. So for example, you know, if you know somebody that's in, I'm going to use a random example. Let's say you know someone in the, you know, or the energy business, and you have a conversation with them and you learn something from them that you can apply as a tactic or a business in your life, or you, let's say in the IT business, can teach them something about process or lean or agile, then they can now apply in their energy business. So I think cross-pollination is very important, and that's why I also encourage open networking. But I would say giving value, going in with the attitude of giving value first is the best tip I can give, the first thing to start doing.
I see. So let's talk about the strategic networking for a little bit.
Sure.
And you said you can, you know, identify a person and figure out a way to reach them through groups or common networks, right? And once you do, and once you make a first contact, then how do you proceed from there? Do you ask for a favor? Do you ask for a help? Do you give something that is valuable to them? What are the next steps after that? That is like the level two of strategic networking.
So level one. So let's say you and I met, shared a cup of coffee, okay? So a couple of questions like how can I help you would be a question that I always ask. And, you know, if you say, you know, Raj, there's someone in this industry or this particular vertical that I'm interested in, I will find a way. So I try to provide introductions to people constantly throughout the week. I'm always introducing people to each other. I find that there's a lot of value in that. So I would ask you, Rohit, who could I introduce you to? Who in my network? Feel free to look through my LinkedIn. Doesn't matter if it's second, third degree contacts. If there's someone I can introduce you to, let me know how I can help you first. Okay? The second thing I do is that, and I encourage everyone to get their own CRM. So I use Insightly, for example. And so I'll take notes in my phone and say, you know, I met Rohit and he's interested in X, Y, and Z. So I'll take some personal notes and I'll put an action in there to follow up with Rohit, you know, a month down the road or a couple of weeks down the road and find out if how he's doing, what's going on, depending on what that particular conversation was based on. I also do handwritten cards. I'm a big fan of handwritten cards, and I send handwritten cards at least three or four a week. And I just find that there's a lot of power in handwritten cards.
What is that that you use, CRM?
I use Insightly.
Insightly?
Correct.
Okay.
It's a free CRM, and I think it allows you to have up to 2,500 contacts.
I see. Yeah, sorry for digressing. I wasn't able to find it online. So yeah, I'll link it in the show notes. And then you talked about the handwritten cards.
Yes.
What else?
And then just follow up. Follow up, I think, is key. I think, you know, if you're familiar with any kind of sales process, then you know that they say fortune is in the follow up. And so I'll tag it in my calendar to reach out to this person and kind of go over, you know, what we talked about and see if there's any other way that can help them. Now, obviously, we're aggregating people here, and not everyone is going to remain on this particular cycle, if you will. But if you can provide enough value to enough individuals over time, then, you know, that brings more value back to you and to your community.
Yeah. So do you have an example of something that helped you through this strategic networking, where you contacted and followed up for a few months and then they helped you back, just as an inspiration for people listening?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's worked for us. So I spent the last year and a half really doing a lot of old-fashioned legwork for our company. And what I was doing, I was really, you know, sowing the seeds of who we are and what we're doing. But the way I've been doing it is providing this value, if you will, to the startup community here in Dallas. I love the startup community. And anything I can help, any way I can help people in the startup community, I'll go out of my way to see how I can do it. So what's happened a year and a half later, you know, we, myself and my co-founder, we've become known as the people around town that people can come to regarding help. So people have a lot of app ideas, a lot of company ideas, and both my co-founder and I have previous entrepreneurship experience. And so now there's a lot of times where we'll get emailed or called where people want us to help them with an idea or taking an idea to fruition. And so that helps us a lot from our company perspective because people learn about us and our company, but it helps us because we're able to provide that value back to our community too.
I see. So anyone who came like that, which helped you in your current business?
So now if I go out and say, you know, I want an introduction to a VC here locally or, you know, someone in a large company here locally, then I can pretty much get an introduction within the next week or two.
I see. One thing that I was very fascinated by when I was doing listening to your other interviews and seeing your through the work you have done on your blog, the writing you have done, mm-hmm. is how much of the internal, how much of it is internal? Like, there are a lot of habits and mindsets that you promote and that you have, which are mm-hmm. helping you with these outside things of success in business and other things, right? So mm-hmm. I was really curious about the self aspect of it. So I want to start with asking, what does the first 2 hours of your morning look like?
So I wake up at 4:30 mm-hmm. And I start off by meditating. And so I sit to meditate probably around 4:45, 4:50. And that meditation usually goes about 30 to 45 minutes. It depends on the day. On the weekends, I try to do it for an hour.
So you wake up at 4:30 in the weekends too?
Yes, okay. I do. Okay. I do. I just find like, I can try to sneak in a nap later in the day, but almost every day I try to wake up 4:30. I have three young daughters. They're 3, 6, and 7. And so I take a very intentional approach in how I structure my day, because after 6:30 a.m., it's their time until they go to school. And then from 6 p.m. to 8 p.m. in the evening, it's their time also. And so I take a very, very, I structure my day so I can spend my time with them. But my first 2 hours is meditation, reading, and most recently, writing. I had committed several times last year, people said, you know, you should write, you should blog. And I gave them BS excuses about, I don't have the time, or what would I do? Honestly, the answer was, you know, I was thinking in my head, what am I going to write about? Who wants to read what I write? And it was that mental game. And, you know, finally, late last year, I committed. I said, January 1st, I'm going to sit down and I'm committing myself, Raj, to writing a minimum of 100 words 3 times a week. And so I sit down, I write whatever I think about when I come out of meditation. I write my blog and I just hit publish and I walk away. My goal is to hit publish by 6:15 and walk away from it.
I see. So your goal is not to, you know, reach more people or whatever. Your goal is to just the activity of writing itself is cathartic, and that's what you want to do. Is that
That's
right?
Correct. It's the activity. It's the discipline. Really the discipline. I find that discipline is really transferable. You know, going back to earlier in our conversation, I think you mentioned in one of your podcasts too, regarding, you know, dieting and weight fluctuation and different areas of life kind of slipping in. And I think that once you can learn to discipline yourself in a particular area, you can use that same skill set to discipline yourself in other areas. And so telling myself, hey, Raja, you've committed to 100 words 3 days a week. Can you do it? No, not can you do it. You will do it. Okay, fine, fair enough. I will do it. And I sit down and I do it.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. So when I start off my mornings with a workout, for example, I know I sweated it out and I already had a big win that helps me and gives me the confidence to crush it at my work and at my other things in life throughout the day.
You're absolutely right. So I mentioned earlier in the conversation about being heavy as a child. At my heaviest, I weighed 260 pounds.
Wow.
And I've been able to keep that weight off for 20 years now. And losing the weight wasn't the key. The key is every day I need to make sure I have the discipline to practice what keeps the weight off.
And what was that for you, practicing every day? What was you practicing every day?
I mean, for me, I go to the gym every day. I work out every day. I watch what I eat every day. Mm-hmm. It's a question of having that transferable discipline that we talked about. Mm-hmm. Is that if I can apply discipline in one area of my life, then I know how to apply it in other areas of my life.
Were you always a morning person?
I wouldn't say I was always a morning person. I used to wake up fairly early, but I mean fairly early meaning 6 o'clock, 7 o'clock. After we had our first daughter, I knew that there were certain things I wanted to continue to do and that I wanted to spend time with her. And so I readjusted my day so I could continue working out in the morning, continue meditation, reading, etc. I think so. To me, those three activities—reading, meditation, and working out—are key pillars of my day.
Yeah, Yeah, I was never a morning person, but I wake up at 5 a.m. every day now. And it started with, like it started with the kit for you, it started with me with podcasting. Now, the only way I can accommodate that is to wake up in the morning, and that's why I do it.
Well, good for you. Good for you.
So, Raj, you mentor a lot of people, right? What are one or two of the mostly MBA grads, I believe? Is that right?
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
That's correct.
What is some of the advice that you give to your mentees?
So I'd say at least half of my mentees are here on F1 visa. So they're foreign students and they're getting their MBA here. And so they face some of the same cultural problems that I faced as a child. So that's a huge barrier for them to overcome, is that how do they assimilate into the, you know, the American culture. And so I help them with networking. I help them with overcoming some of these mental barriers, if you will. So, you know, thinking about how to present themselves, not being afraid to speak up, you know, culturally speaking, as Asians, we're taught differently. We're brought up differently. So, you know, putting your hand up and giving answers is not something that we were taught to do as kids. And so I help them with a lot, overcoming a lot of these soft skill issues more than on the academic side, they're phenomenal. They're all 3.9, 4.0. That's fine. But that's not what holds them back. It's really the mindset and the mental game that holds them back.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you're talking about just speaking up when you have your opinion rather than just shared, which as Asians you are often taught to do.
Right. Speaking up and, you know, not trying to be afraid of looking stupid or thinking that people already know that. Why should I say that? Because everyone brings a different perspective on something. And so, right, somebody may already know the answer to something, but you may shine a totally different perspective on it that they hadn't realized.
I see. And you were going to start something asking your mentees to show their resume. What's about that you wanted to say?
Yes. So, you know, usually it's two or three of them together on the first meeting. And what I do is I tell them to cover their name and show me their resumes, just to point out to them that on paper, they're essentially the same person. They've done statistics, they've done accounting, they've done strategy, whatever it might be. But the few things that are going to differentiate them, their networking is going to differentiate them, their ability to communicate is going to differentiate them, and their mental mindset is what's going to differentiate them from everyone else in their class. And so when they're going for an interview or a conversation with a potential employer, how to differentiate themselves from their peers?
There is another question that you ask your mentees, which I was really fascinated by, which is the R&D budget.
Yes. So
tell me about that.
This one really resonates with them because they speak this language. So I had a mentor many, many years ago, and you know, he asked me, you know, Raj, what are you? And I would tell him, and he'd say, you need to read more, invest more. And eventually, I grew to understand what this reading and investing meant. And so now when I sit down with a mentee, I ask him or her, tell me your R&D budget. And very often I get a blank look. And what do you mean my R&D budget? I say, well, if you look at any of these progressive companies like Microsoft, or if you look at Apple or Google, whoever they are, pull their 10K, you will see a line item in there for R&D. And this line item does not go away based on how the economy is doing. This line item is always there. And so when I say to them, what is your personal R&D budget? I'm asking them, how are you investing in yourself? And if you don't invest in yourself, why do you expect your employer to invest in you? So what are you reading? What podcasts are you listening to? What seminars are you going to? How are you educating yourself? And are you allocating a portion of your income or your revenue, depending on use the word, towards investing in yourself in your own research, in your own R&D, essentially.
I see. So you're talking about both investing in time and money, whatever is appropriate for the learning.
Absolutely. Time and money, both.
I see. Oh, it's been a fun interview. What did you think so far, Raj? I want you to give me an honest feedback on air.
Yeah, I'm really enjoying it. I mean, the technical issues are the technical issues. Mm-hmm. I think what you're doing is a phenomenal job, and I think I'm not sure about who your audience is right now, if it's people in the US, people overseas, if you can elaborate.
Sure. So my audience is mostly because of me and my network, it's mostly Indian, and I think 70% of the people are in the US and 30% of the people are in India.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, you know, I hope that, you know, we've been able to provide something of value to your audience. I feel that, you know, I'm proud of you for taking the step for doing this. We all talk about doing things, but you know, until you take that action, that first step, I think we talked about lessons learned earlier. I'm sure you've learned so much in these last 6 months and that you're going to improve on that too. So like you just talked about the Skype, for example, that's a lesson in learning too.
Yeah, absolutely. Raj, if someone wants to get in touch with you, what is the best way for them to find you?
They can email me. My Yahoo email address is raj_daniels@yahoo.com. I'm on Twitter also, raj_daniels. That's probably the best to do it.
Okay. I will link it in the show notes as well. Thank you so much, Raj, for joining us today.
Roy, thank you again so much, and I really appreciate what you do.
Thank you for tuning in. To get updates on latest episodes, make sure you subscribe with your email by going over to breakingtheborders.com. If you know anyone good as a guest, shoot me an email. I will reach out to the guest, get hold of them, and ask them all the questions that you have. My email is rohit@breakingtheborders.com. Thanks again and have an amazing day.